Okay. Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming. It's a lovely day to be spent in a stuffy room. So today we're going to do the today's lecture is going to be a lot more practical than most of the course. Hence the title, Practical Considerations in the Design of Pay-for-Performance Plans. We're going to learn about how the ideas that we studied in the theoretical foundations, behind the theoretical foundations of CNB, are implemented in practice. I have budgeted two lectures for Practical Considerations of Performance Pay Plans. But if we run very fast, I will do two lectures today. Then, if we go ahead of the schedule, then the next lecture will be the lecture about benefits, practical considerations behind benefits plans. And then the next two lectures will be about performance evaluation. I have a huge, big lecture on performance evaluation, which I think is very, very interesting, and I would love to spend two lectures on performance evaluation, if possible. If not, then we'll just get back to our original plan. So, pay for performance. We've learned in theory that you need to offer incentives to the workers in situations when their effort is not observed, which is most of the time, and there is an agency issue. Right, so to deal with agency issue in the context when effort is not perfectly observed, theory dictates that firms should offer incentives, and firms do offer incentives, and the way that incentives are actually implemented in practice differs very much by firm, by industry, by country, even by culture. There used to be a lecture on cultural, international dimension of compensation benefits. It no longer is in the program, but there is even a cultural dimension of the way incentive pay is practiced. So what are we going to learn about today? We're going to learn about the various ways of administering incentive pay plans. We're going to look at incentives offered in the form of fixed pay. Yes, there are incentives offered in the form of fixed pay, even though it's a theoretical misnomer and it's not a very good practice, but it does exist. We will look much more carefully into the way of variable pay, which is related to some performance measure. And under this heading, we will look at individual incentive plans, not the way they should look in theory, but emphatically the way they are practiced in firms. We look at group incentive plans, because incentives can be offered to individuals as well as to teams. There are reasons for offering individual incentives. There are reasons against offering individual incentives, which we will compare in this group. And we will finish this particular topic by reflecting on long-term versus short-term incentives. So we should have plenty of time to do this, and maybe we will even begin the next lecture. Maybe not, I don't know. So the most frequently occurring practice of offering incentives by way of adjusting fixed wage is known in the literature as merit pay. So merit pay is what happens when firms want to reward the superior current performance of its workers. It can offer a merit pay increase. You know, you get promoted, not necessarily from one position to another, but you may get promoted from one pay scale to another pay scale. So you will get some positive delta on top of your existing fixed wage, which is a permanent increase in your fixed pay. It does depend on current performance, of course. That's hence the incentive element of it. But it's permanent, right? And that's the biggest problem with merit pay, that it's permanent. It depends on current performance evaluation. Come next year, performance evaluation goes down, but you cannot, or you may find it very hard. It's not theoretically impossible, but you may find it very hard to withdraw the merit pay that you have offered to your good employees in this current year. It cannot be recalled. So therefore, the question is, how do you incentivize future effort by offering yet another permanent pay increase? You could try to incentivize future effort by offering yet another pay increase, and that's what firms do. You see indeed that wage seniority profiles are very positive, upward-looking, and very steep. Some researchers even find them to be convex, so you get higher pay increase the longer you stay in the firm, depending on your performance. But the mathematics of merit pay suggests that in order for merit pay to make economic sense, and remember, every incentive scheme has to make economic sense, it has to increase the efficiency of firms' operations rather than decrease it. In order for merit pay to make economic sense, the incremental increases in merit pay have to be rather small, because the total amount of the merit pay that firms offer to its workers is really the sum of discounted future values of this merit pay. Right? You know the formula for the discounted value of the annuity? Yeah, so you get, say, an extra 100 euros every month in higher wages. What is the present value of this annuity? Well, it's the infinite geometric progression. It's 100 euros divided by R, where R is the applicable interest rate. Well, it's an approximation, but yeah. So 100 euros seems little money, but when you divide it by something little, which is the interest rate, say 1% or 2%, whatever, applicable, then you're talking about many thousands of euros that you have to spend on merit pay, and then the question is it worth it or not? So it's expensive and it can't be recalled. So if you want to incentivize performance, the realistic option is to keep increasing wages rather than adjusting wages in light of current performance. And this is an illustration which throws some figures at the idea that merit pay is actually quite expensive, because you need to discount it. You need to discount it by the applicable interest rate. Now, an alternative to merit pay, which many firms practice, is lump sum bonus. Now, this is not a permanent. The only difference is that it's not a permanent increase in your pay. Right, so it's not built into base pay. You basically receive a lump sum bonus the next quarter after the end of the current financial year. Most of the bonuses, at least in Germany, are paid in early to mid-March. So when the results from the previous year are duly recorded and calculated. So it's different from merit pay in that it's less expensive in the long run, because you can withdraw it depending on performance, and you can manage it more effectively than merit pay, which is very hard to withdraw. The textbook, which is background reading for this course, the Gerhardt and Ryan's textbook, Compensation, says in the respective chapter, in chapter 10, that the lump sum bonus is viewed as less of an entitlement than merit pay. I have my doubts about it. It's a very cultural thing. In North America, where the authors of this book come from, it may indeed be viewed as less of an entitlement than merit pay, because you know it's the incentives are powerful. And labor markets are flexible, and the relational contracts between firms and workers are pretty straightforward, and are designed very much with the idea of offering pay for performance, and which implies offering no pay for no performance. Now, in continental Europe, things are slightly different, culturally, institutionally, culturally as well as institutionally. In the continental Europe, Very recent research and journalism journalist articles suggest that that bonuses which are offered in to many many workers at the end of the financial year are viewed increasingly as an entitlement. Very rarely are the bonuses not paid. So even a few years ago when the recession was still on the way, now it's officially no recession, we're back to the period of growth and prosperity and optimism, but a few years ago when there was still a recession, still the end of the year bonuses were paid, and some firms were even making calculations, making budget plans for the next years, and they were already budgeting performance bonuses before any performance result is realized. So it is an entitlement, but at least you can withdraw this entitlement without expensive legal process, unlike permanent merit pay increase. So a variety of lump sum bonus is known as spot awards. They are the biggest difference between spot awards and lump sum bonus is that the spot awards are discretionary. Lump sum bonus is typically written in some kind of document, right? You receive information about the criteria, the nominal criteria for lump sum bonus. They are typically very vaguely defined because lump sum bonus is basically paid all the time, or it's very unlikely that it will not be paid. But at least you get some document saying that you should receive lump sum bonus and the conditions are such, such, and such. The spot awards are discretionary. They are not written in the contract. Right? You may or may not be given a spot award. It needn't be precisely formulated for what. It acts as a monetary incentive, as a very peculiar monetary incentive, because what is so peculiar with spot awards from the basic theory point of view? The basic theory point of view has it that the contract, the rules according to which incentives are calculated and paid must be set on paper so that they can be enforced in the court. If they are not enforceable in the court, like spot award, for instance, which may or may not be given at pleasure of the principal, then the principal will have an incentive not to give spot awards, right? If you don't have to offer an award, why do you offer an award, right? The workers anticipate that the principals will have an incentive not to give spot awards, even for good performance, and will not exert effort to deliver good performance. That's what the basically theory is saying. But here comes a more advanced theory, which we may cover, I think we will cover during the tutorial about performance evaluation, I think. There is a theory of relational incentive contracts. Have you heard of it? Relational contracts? No? It's basically an adaptation of a very simple idea from basic industrial organization. You may have heard about, you may still recall from your bachelor study the notion of collusion. You heard of collusion? Yeah. So when there is an oligopolistic market and there are firms, they can either compete or they can collude. Now, if the market is stable and if the discount rates are not very high, then it's more profitable for firms to collude rather than to defect, and so the collusion emerges even in the absence of formal communication. So the relational incentive contract is a fairly straightforward application of this principle. There is some basic maths which shows that if both the principal and the agent have not too high discount rates for the future, they will value their reputation. The principal will value the future gains that high effort of the agent will deliver, and therefore the principal will have an incentive to offer discretionary awards rather than to withdraw them, even though the obligation to do so is not written on paper. So let's consider the situation without discretionary awards. So you have incentives written in the contract, right? And you may or may not have incentive pay written in the contract. Now, Suppose some contingency happens which was not envisaged in the contract. Well, to use your example, an employee gets an offer from another firm. Yeah? And the current firm wants to keep this employee, for example, right? So one way of keeping this employee is to offer them a discretionary award, right? So, okay. Now, the problem with incentives written in the contract is that no contract can possibly cover each and every state of the world. You cannot write down all the eventualities in the contract. Something is going to happen that you haven't thought about. And you need to have the possibility to react in the situations that were not envisaged in your contract. So contracts are incomplete. Right? Now, in order to be able to act, in order to have the wiggle room to improve your performance in situations not covered in the contract, you need to have a discretion. And here comes the discretionary spot award. So I think we've cleared this. Yes, it's possible. Now, another reason is, in order to have formal incentives, you need to have a measure of performance. Right? You can't have incentives without a measure of performance. The problem with performance measurement, and we will spend quite a lot of time discussing it, is that performance measures are typically noisy, and often performance measures are not really relevant and not really very well related to the real, to the outcomes desired by the firm. The firm wants to increase its long-term value, but long-term value takes long-term to be realized. It needs to reward its workers now. What sort of measure of performance is it using? Short-run accounting profits. Now, short-run accounting profits are not perfectly related to the long-term value of the firm. There is a misalignment between the performance measure that the firm is using and the outcome that it desires. The French colonizers wanted to have a clean city, but their performance measure was rat tails. There was clearly a misalignment. Right? So in such situations, firms have to have recourse to what's known as subjective performance evaluation, right? Now, subjective performance evaluation is what you have just done today. You subjectively evaluated my performance. And this information is valuable to the principal, to the University of Constance, to define or maybe redefine my employment contract. Now, if you have incentives based on subjective performance evaluation, then they are by definition discretionary. Because subjective performance evaluation is not verifiable in the court. If I think you're a good worker, I can't prove that you're a good worker, other than my ideas that you're a good worker. If I think you're a bad worker, I can't show it in the court. So the subjective performance evaluation involves an element of discretion, hence the discretionary awards based on subjective performance evaluation. So there are two reasons for discretionary award. First, the incompleteness of contracts, and second, the subjectivity in measures of performance that firms use to evaluate and reward their workers. Okay, so but of course, the biggest story is a story about various incentive plans, and there are lots and lots of incentive plans. So you have a basic theory of incentives, which has linear incentive contract. What other type of incentive contracts do we know from basic theory? The target bonus contract, we also studied in the theory lecture. Now, of course, the theory also has tournament-based incentives, which we haven't studied in this course. The theory has team incentives, which we haven't studied in this course. But basically, the number of types of incentives that the theory really can mathematically describe is not that many. The number of various ways in which firms use to design their incentive schemes runs into, I don't know, tens of thousands. I guess each firm has its own specific incentive plan. So here is a very, very coarse classification of incentive plans. So we have incentive plans that are labeled as cash profit sharing, so profit sharing plans. What it basically is there is a profit realized at the end of a certain accounting period, and a certain fraction of this profit, say 10%, is shared, hence the name, is shared with the workers of the firm. So how can you relate cash profit sharing plans to any sort of to a theoretical model of investment? Well, cash profit sharing is a team incentive, with or without the target, as the case may be. Now, another type of incentive plans is stock ownership or option. Everybody knows what stock ownership is, right? It's very popular nowadays. Well, maybe not so much in continental Europe, but it's getting there as well. You get a certain amount of shares of the company you work in. And what's even more interesting, you get the option, you get the right to buy these shares at a previously defined price. What is the incentive here? Yeah? The incentive here is, if you work hard, your firm does well. If your firm does well, its share price goes up. If its share price goes up, then the price at which you can exercise your option to buy shares is below the market price. So if you exercise your option and then sell the shares of your firm, you get a profit. Okay, it's very, very easy. Well, not really all that easy, because there are various, you know, blueprint and small print in the way or stock options operate. What we typically learn at universities about stock options is that a recent trend in the stock options administration has been to delay the time period at which stock option can be exercised. So you can exercise your stock option today, but you can cash on your shares in, let's say, 1 year's time from now. Why is this in place? Well, because it's possible to artificially increase short-term accounting profits by, for example, rebooking the existing orders to earlier dates, or to do some creative accounting, or right to increase short-term profits. The market will register an increase in short-term profits. The share price will go up. You will cash in on your shares, but then at the end of the day, the share price will go down, but you don't really care because you've already cashed in. Another trick that you can do is you can say, we're going to acquire this firm. We're going to do a merger or acquisition with another firm. Now, typically, when a firm announces a merger or acquisition, its share price goes up. So what you need to do, suppose you're a CEO and you have stock options which you can exercise immediately, how can you make yourself a multimillionaire? You could say a few words. I am going to acquire firm X. Stock share price will increase, you'll cash in your options. Then this merger and acquisition will prove a disaster, as the majority of mergers and acquisitions are in reality. But by that time, you'll probably be kicked out of the board of directors with a golden parachute, and you'll have a nice house and basically your life sorted. In order to prevent this from happening, you have a moratorium period between the time that you can buy your, you can exercise your stock option and cash in on your shares, so as to make your decisions a bit more consistent with the considerations of firm value in the longer run. So. And there is a large class of incentive plans which is based on a performance evaluation method called balanced scorecard. So that brings me back to the good question that Ege asked some minutes ago. He said, why do you need to exercise discretion? You need to exercise discretion for two reasons, which I have mentioned. And here, the reason is that, you know, sometimes you want to evaluate performance using subjective criteria, subjective measures, rather than objective, because no objective measure of performance is good enough. And one popular way of doing subjective performance evaluation and rewarding people based on subjective performance evaluation result is called balanced scorecard. This is how balanced scorecard looks like. Let me discuss. Yeah, there we are. This is how a balanced scorecard looks like. There are lots of objectives, but of course the most interesting part in this balanced scorecard is the column called measures. So these are all the performance measures that are relevant for your career, for your pay, for your success with this organization. Some of these measures are objective, like revenue growth, like asset utilization rate, like operation costs. You can calculate them. These are hard data, right? Some of the performance measures that are relevant, that are specified in the balanced scorecard that affect your performance evaluation and your pay in the end, are subjective measures, like customer satisfaction rating, an extremely subjective measure. Right? So a balanced scorecard basically brings together all the measures of performance that the firm thinks are relevant to assess your contribution to its long-term value. And depending on the some weighted average of your performance ratings on these items in the balanced scorecard, you receive a certain score. Depending on the value of this score, it could be but doesn't have to be with targets. So targets are optional. You will get your bonus. So this is the incentive based on balanced scorecard. Now you can get productivity or gain sharing plans. The difference between productivity and profit sharing plans are that profit sharing plans are by definition about getting a share of profit distributed among individual workers or teams of workers. The gain sharing plans are they are not about profit. They are about more immediate outcomes of people's activities. For instance, you know, suppose I'm making chairs. The immediate outcome of my activity is the number of chairs that I make. And if I am in the productivity or gain sharing plan rather than profit sharing plan, then I will get my incentives based on the number of chairs I produce. I don't care about the market conditions. I don't care about the macroeconomy. I don't care about fashion. I don't care about brand, right? Because all I get paid for is the number of chairs I produced, which makes sense sometimes because it is a better measure of my effort. And because it's a better measure of my effort, I don't need to have such a high risk premium. Yeah, so that's an advantage of gain sharing plans. Now the disadvantage is that the number of chairs that I produce is not the final outcome, is not what makes the firm sail or sink, right? What makes my firm sail or sink is how successful these chairs will be on the market, is how much they will sell for and in what quantity. So if firm thinks that I can somehow influence the perceptions of these chairs by the market, if I can somehow influence how much they can be sold for and how quickly, then the firm will incentivize me not based on the number of chairs that I produce but based on the amount of profit that these chairs will realize. And this brings us back to the profit sharing plans. And you have the incentives that offered to individual workers, and you have incentives offered to teams of workers. Lots of interesting information summarized for you in this table. Pretty straightforward ideas here. Most of the points here are pretty straightforward. I would like to go through in some larger degree of detail through particular incentive plans that you could see practiced in firms. So I will start with individual incentive plans, and you can have individual incentive plans based on the units of production. So your performance measure is the number of chairs that you will make, or You can have individual incentives based on the time it takes to create one unit of production. So I may get my incentives based on the number of chairs I make, and it doesn't matter how much time I spend per chair, or I can get my incentives based on the amount of time I spend per chair. The less, the better. Of course, this makes sense if I get paid by the hour. You know, like in this Edward Lazier study, people were paid by the hour before the introduction of piece rate. So I'm a worker, I receive, let's say, 20 euros per hour. I can either take coffee breaks and still get my 20 euros per hour, or I can actually make chairs. How can you incentivize me to make chairs rather than drink coffee, given that I receive hourly pay? I can get some incentives depending on the time it takes me to produce one chair. So the less time it takes me to produce one chair, the more I get paid, so I will work harder. Or alternatively, I can get paid per every chair that I produce. And there are different techniques, I would call them industrial engineering techniques: Taylor differential piece rate system, Merrick multiple piece rate system, Halsey 50-50, Rowan Gantt plan. So these are basically the sort of essentially engineering quantitative accounting rules that apply to rewarding people based on the time or units that they produce. So let's look at some of these plans. Let me discover them. Yeah, so some of the plans, I just want to give examples how they work and relate through these examples, these plans, to the underlying theoretical models of incentives, so as to show you why they act as incentive plans. So here's a gain sharing plan, which is known in the industrial management literature as Scanlon plan. Don't worry, we'll get back to the previous slides, so we will cover it. Here's how it works. You have the value of production 10,000 euros, of which wages are 4. So these are the baseline data. Think of it as some kind of target. Right, you learn that the share of wages in the monetary value of production is 40%. Now, in the current year, you produce 12,000 euros worth of chairs. You're not worried about how many chairs you produce. You just sell 12,000 euros worth of chairs. Now, given that you now sell more, what are your target wages? What is your wage budget? Your wage budget, according to historical figures, is 40% of the monetary value of your production. So your wage budget should be 4,800 euros, 40%, right? However, because people worked harder, they needed less time to create this much output, or maybe they didn't need so many workers to create this much output, again, because they worked harder. So the actual wages, thanks to the manager squeezing every last bit of effort from the poor fruit pickers in Bandiera, Barranca, and Rasul's study, the actual wages is 3,000 euros rather than 4,800. So there is a difference between budgeted wage and the actual wage of 1,800 euros. And, then there is a little bit of political economy of gain sharing between the managers, the executive management of the firm, and the workers. The workers get, you know, let's say 10% of these wage savings, so 180 euros is distributed among the workers, and the rest goes as a bonus to the CEO, thanks to whose revolutionary ideas these wage savings were realized. Now, so why does it operate as an incentive? Do you have a question? No, right. So why does it operate as an incentive? Because the cheaper you end up producing a given amount of stuff, the more saving you will have as a difference between the budget, between how much money you can spend, and how much money you actually spend. So very, very simple idea. The harder you work, the greater the output, Therefore, the higher the wage budget as proportion of your output, and the lower the actual wage budget. So what makes the marginal product of your effort not zero is the difference between this number, which increases with your effort, and this number, which decreases with your effort. So you work harder under scandal plan than without any incentive plan. That makes sense? It's very easy, right? It looks weird, you know. Why don't you just do a non-standard piece rate? There are various reasons, and the main reason here is, and actually the same thing applies to many, many different performance pay plans practiced in reality. Most of the performance pay plans practiced in reality, they include somewhere inside their internal architecture, they include the notion of a performance target. Two questions. Where is the target in Scanlon plan? And second question is, why do you need this target? So the target in the Scanlon plan is this 40%, the historic share of wages in the total output. This is used as a performance target against which, using which information, the amount of money to be shared, the amount of money to be classified as gains is calculated. And the second question, I would say more interesting, at least to me, is why do you need the target? You know, why don't you just do linear incentive scheme like we know it? Why do you need a performance target? At some point, I think I'll have a course about why we need a performance target. But now, a very short answer to this question is, if you go back to the theory of incentive pay and recall that we have a few slides in the lecture about performance targets, you will see that performance target can deliver a first best solution in terms of effort and efficiency, even when the limited liability constraint binds. Remember this story? Yeah? So without performance target, you can't have the first best without having to pay to your worker a negative fixed wage. Remember the story? The incentive linear piece contract looks very weird. Its piece rate is 1, so the worker gets all the output that he produces, but its fixed wage is negative. Very, very weird. Very few people actually work under this. A lot more people work under target performance contracts. Why? Because when you have a target, you can design a performance contract in such a way that the fixed wage will be above zero, and yet the effort level that people will put in their work will be at its efficient level. So very often you have performance targets, and including such targets in incentive pay schemes make a lot of sense from the theoretical point of view. And there are, of course, other reasons why targets exist, for greater accountability, for the ease of budgeting, for the ease of calculation, to have more certainty. We are motivated by the very existence of targets, so there's a host of theoretical explanations, but the most important thing is here, when you have a target, you can get an efficient solution to the incentive problem, which is efficient in terms of effort exerted. So another variety of individual incentive plan can be extended to groups as well, is a so-called Rooker plan. So that's how it works. You calculate incentives not based on wages, but based on productivity. So in the base year, you had a total wage budget, historic information, exogenous, 100 euros. So if you spend 100 euros on hiring workers, the workers who you hire, using the equipment that you have, will create the output worth, say, 556 euros, right? You calculate the value added. You calculate the value added of this output. What is value out of what is value added? Value added is the output minus intermediate costs of production. You know this formula from basic economics, right? So the 40% of this figure is value added, which is the product of labor and capital. Now, when you calculate the labor costs, 100 euros, the labor costs make up 45% of value added, right? Now, you can also calculate the so-called productivity ratio, which is how much output is produced from €1 of labor costs. It's basically, you know, $1 spent on wages results in 556 euros spent received as income. Okay, in the current year, you hired more workers, so you paid more wages. Wow, that's bad news if you practice Scanlon plan, right? Well, wait. But you hire a lot of people, but your output also goes way up. Now, your target output is how much? Your target output is this much. Where do you have this figure from? You have this figure from this productivity ratio. If the historic productivity ratio is this, then if you hire so many workers, you should get so much output. In fact, the workers who you hire are work harder and are more productive than your target suggests. The difference is 133 euros between the target and the actual. Now, what is the output gain which is due to labor rather than other factors? Well, the production function argument suggests that the share of output gain due to labor is the total output gain, which is 133 euros times the share of labor in value added. And this 133 times 45%, whatever it is, constitutes the pot of money that firms have to distribute between themselves and its workers. So where are the incentives here? The incentives here is not to cut down wage costs. The incentives here is to increase productivity beyond the historic productivity ratio. And to the extent to which you increase productivity beyond the historic productivity ratio, you create extra money that part of which may be distributed to you as a bonus. Is there a target in the Rucker plan? Sure, the productivity ratio is your target. Why do you need the target? Don't start with this. You need the target to deliver a solution which is efficient in terms of effort. Okay. So, not all gains are distributed to the workers as the bonus. Why? Again, we have a very simple theoretical answer for this. Not only because they are greedy capitalists. Go to the socialist Venezuela and you will see that it's even less there. Not only because they are greedy capitalists, the theoretical explanation for this injustice is that the optimal beta in an incentive compensation plan for a risk-averse worker is strictly less than one, right? Why is it strictly less than one? Because when the error term is negative, when there is a negative shock to output, the worker is insured against it by receiving a fixed wage, but the firm has to compensate. And in order to provide this insurance, the fixed wage above zero requires mathematically, for this contract to break even, requires the share of output created by the worker that is distributed to the worker in the form of incentive pay to be strictly less than one. So, sometimes I hear questions about this, these various plans. Are there any more plans? Okay, thankfully not. Sometimes I hear questions about this, but why are they so complicated? You know, why can't you just have, okay, you want to have a target, you have a target. You specify the target, and if you sell above the target, then that's the budget of money that you can spend on bonuses. Well, the procedural complication of these plans is not only the result of extra hours of work by C&B consultants who have built the firms run by Mr. Scanlon and Rucker for their services. It also has to do with the way accounting procedures are organized in firms. Now, this is not a course in accounting, and I'm not a specialist in accounting, but what little I know suggests that unlike we assume in basic economics, The very process of calculating things like output and things like production costs is wrought with a number of interesting procedural, behavioral, and even strategic issues. So there need to be procedures in place that calculate the quantities relevant for the administration of various incentive pay scheme. And in order to integrate the incentives into the existing accounting procedures within the firm, you need these targets and productivity ratio and historic shares of wages in the total output. The basic theory of incentive doesn't need these elaborations, but the actual accounting practices in existing firms require so. So these are individual pay plans which can be based on the time. This is your Scanlon plan, or they can be based on actual output, which is your Rooker plan, as an example. These are individual plans. Now, not all incentives are individual based. In fact, I would say quite a lot of incentives, I'm not sure if it's majority, but quite a lot of incentives is based on team effort. And there's a very good reason for it. There's a very good reason for it that many incentives are team rather than individual based. Like it or not, teamwork is now the predominant way of working. I personally hate it. I don't like teamwork. And yet, if you look at my research output, then most of it is created in cooperation with other people. So you have to cooperate. You have to work in a team, whether you like it or not. Yeah? So, and if teams are so important for reasons that are beyond the scope of this course, if teams are so important, you need to recognize the existence of the teams as a major element of production technology and integrate the presence of the teams in the practices of incentive pay. So what it means in plain language, that rather than giving money to each worker who has contributed in a clear, measurable way to the firm's output, the contributions to output or to the reduction of production costs above the target are shared among the members of the team that has collectively delivered this contribution. So these are the team incentives. Now, there are good things happening and bad things happening when you have team incentives. So what are the good things from the incentives point of view? Well, one good thing is that it's much easier to calculate team's output than individual output. Why so? Well, some of you attended my incentive seminar. And as part of the seminar assignment, there was a seminar presentation and the seminar paper, which was done in pairs, right? So, some people had to present individually, but for instance, Elisa worked with Dana, right? So, I can give you a very precise estimate of your output in terms of words, for instance, or in terms of grade that you get, right? So I can give you various measures of your collective output. But what was your output, Elisa, in your groups? It's difficult. It's even difficult to say for you. Because even if you were calculating the words that you, even if you were calculating the words that you wrote, right, you may be reluctant to reveal this information for various strategic reasons, right? Suppose you really shirked and Dana did most of the work. I'm not saying that it's the case, but suppose, as an example, right? Then you would be reluctant to say, look, I'm a shirker. Suppose, on the other hand, that you did much of the work and Dana was shirking, right? Many people find it psychologically difficult to point fingers and say, you are the shirker and I did all the work, right? So the revelation of individual output within teams is technologically complicated, but it can also be strategically undesirable, right? So if you cannot calculate individual outputs of people within the team, then the choice is really bad. Either you forget about incentives altogether, or you use whatever measure is available to administer incentives, which is team output. Now, we know that incentives are better than no incentives, because when there's no incentives, it's hard to understand why people work at all. So you need to have a little bit of incentives, and when you have incentives, you should use whatever measure of output you have, which is the team output. So another good thing that happens when you offer team incentives is offering team incentives is a very natural way of encouraging cooperation. Yeah? So teams exist everywhere, but if you think about reasons why team exists, it's not because people think that teams are cool. No, teams exist because the technology of production requires a combination of different inputs that different people possess in a complementary way. It basically, the necessity to have teams is dictated by technology to a large extent, rather than society or fashion or ideology, right? And teams exist because of complementarities in the production process, and complementarities in the production process require effort to be complementary, which involves a lot of cooperation. So you need, not only do you need teams in a nominal sense, right? A team in a nominal sense is, a couple of guys, one of whom worked and the other one didn't have time to work. It's not nominally a team, right? But it's not a very well-functioning team, and as a result, this team disintegrates. So you need cooperation. How do you encourage cooperation? You introduce team incentives. Yeah? So it's one of the most natural ways of encouraging team cooperation beyond, team building exercises and other frivolities as far as incentive theory is concerned. Now, let's move on and say, well, if team incentives are so cool, why are not all incentives are team incentives? Why there are some individual incentives? Well, because team incentives have disadvantages. So there are advantages of team incentives, such as encouraging cooperation and incentives being better than no incentives. And when you can't calculate the output of an individual in a team, you have to use team output as a base of incentives, in which case incentives become team incentives. But there are also disadvantages of team incentives. What are the disadvantages of team incentives? The biggest disadvantage of team incentives is free riding. Have you heard of free riding? Everybody's heard about free riding, right? And you know the basic model, this Holmstrom budget-breaking model of free riding, yeah? So when you have a team which produces output, which is then shared between its members, the marginal benefit of your effort is equal to the marginal product, the marginal output divided by the team size, whereas the marginal cost of effort is equal to the marginal cost of your effort. So this 1 over n in front of the marginal benefit of effort obviously reduces the optimal effort that each individual team member contributes. Each individual team member contributes. This is a phenomenon known as 1 over n problem. It's also known as free riding, and there is plenty of free riding in teams, let's face it. No. People try to fight free riding because free riding is inefficient. And they try to fight free riding in two ways. First, they supervise. Second, they devise incentives that somehow prevent free riding. So this point in the textbook speaks about supervision. If you offer individual incentives, then people decide in an incentive-compatible way, people decide on the optimal effort level for themselves. And if you devise incentives in a clever way, if you calculate the optimal beta, you can offer incentive pay package so that the agent will choose himself or herself the level of effort that maximizes your profit given the circumstances. So there's no problem or very little problem for supervision to maintain reasonable output level. People will achieve reasonable output level themselves being incentivized. That's not the case with teams, because when you offer team incentives, people will free ride. Okay? So given a standard linear incentive scheme in teams, people will free ride. And you need to supervise, you need additional supervision, both formal and informal, to make sure that everybody in the team delivers their efficient share of effort. What this textbook doesn't mention, and what I think I will add in the next edition of this lecture, is that you can actually create team incentives in a way that will encourage everybody to put in, not to free ride, and put in an efficient level of effort. Does anybody know how team incentives can be created to guarantee optimal effort? The so-called budget breaking rule. Have you studied it in public economics maybe, or micro? No? Right, okay, so very easy. Now, you know it works with risk neutral agents, as all target incentive based schemes, they require risk neutral agents. And of course, it's not exactly the case. But for a risk neutral agent, the principal knows the efficient output, the principal knows production function, and from this production function, the principal can work out the efficient level of effort. The next thing that the principal says, guys, if your output meets or exceeds a target, which the principal strategically chooses to be the efficient level of production, if your output exceeds this target, you get a bonus. If your output falls below this target, you'll get zero, and whatever output you produce, I will appropriate myself. This is a so-called budget-breaking rule, which was first derived by Bengt Holmström, a recent Nobel Prize winner in economics. And if we have time in the tutorial, I will show you how it works precisely. But yes, you can devise team incentives that obviate the need for a lot of supervision. Say reduce rather than obviate. Okay, so there are advantages and disadvantages of individual pay plans, and by extension, there are advantages and disadvantages of team pay plans. So these are the group pay plans. Now, gain sharing we did, profit, success, and risk sharing plans. We also discussed advantages and disadvantages of group incentive plans. We did. Oh, yes. Now, let us look at the management of compensation and benefits. This lecture is about practical aspects of CNB management. So, this is a table which summarizes the choices, depending on the circumstances, that dictate whether a firm should implement individual incentives or team incentives. So, let us try to make sense of this table. Now, choose an individual pay plan when good measures of individual performance exist and task accomplishment does not depend on the performance of the others. And use team incentives when output is a group collaborative effort and individual contributions to output cannot be assessed. We've already spoken about it, haven't we? Right? One reason why team incentives are good is precisely because individual contributions to output cannot be assessed. And output is a collaborative effort, which means output is not just the sum of individual contributions, there are also positive synergies, right? So when the technology is such that there are synergies between individual contributions and individual contributions cannot be adequately assessed, you have no choice but to use team incentives. However, when you have precise measures of individual performance, then the benefits of team incentives will have to be reassessed against the opportunity of individual incentives, and the chance that individual incentive will be the optimal incentive scheme increases because individual incentives don't have free riding, whereas team incentives do. So when you have good measure of performance, you're more likely to practice individual incentives. And task accomplishment does not depend on performance of the others. This basically, this is the direct contradiction to the idea of collaboration. And so collaboration means that your productivity depends on the contribution of others. When it's not the case, there's no collaboration, no need for teams. Choose an individual plan when individual performance standards are stable and production methods and labor mix are relatively constant. And choose a group plan when performance standards change and production methods and labor mix adapt to meet changing pressures. So, why are these considerations important? The exact theoretical analysis of the importance of these considerations requires a lot more maths that I can possibly arrange, but let me hand wave my way around this issue. You see, when you have a well-known production function, this means that production methods and labor mix are relatively constant and they are understood and they can be estimated from previous performance, then you can have a very precise idea about individual effort contributions and individual effort levels by observing individual outputs. Then if you can observe individual outputs, the efficient thing to do is to reward individual outputs rather than team output, which will open the door for free riding. So the stability of production technology basically improves the quality of your knowledge about individual efforts, and you should make use of this knowledge and reward people's individual efforts rather than some collective effort. Now, when you have an environment which is characterized by instability, where production methods constantly change, when there's a lot of noise in observations, you don't have a good knowledge of how the production function really looks like, you should use team incentives, because the teams of people are very good at self-organizing, are very good at finding the optimal way to achieve a certain task, to produce a certain product. There is plenty of local knowledge which cannot be cataloged, which cannot be patented, and which cannot be easily revealed to outsiders, but rather constitutes an intangible individual or team-specific capital within a given organization, right? And everybody who have worked in some team for a long enough time can attest to the wisdom of this observation. For instance, if I were to change my team of colleagues and start working with another team, I would be a lot less productive, because I would have to spend a lot of time explaining people and building relationships with the team which already exist in my current production team. Now, organizational commitment strongest to individual's profession or superior viewed as unbiased and performance standards readily apparent. Then you should use individual plans. You should use team plans when there's high commitment to organization, built upon sound communication of organizational objectives and performance standards. Organizational commitment and union status, I will simply not comment on, because I tried and I found reasons for and against individual versus team plans. At some point I came to a conclusion that that the interpretation of these ideas within, you know, the corpus of theories that we use for compensation benefits is too vague. Okay, a couple of examples of group incentive plans before we finish today's lecture. They come from business case studies, predominantly by Harvard Business School. Harvard Business School is an intellectual leader in the economics of incentives, with George Baker and Robert Gibbons were at some point working there. So this is General Electric Information Systems. It's a subsidiary of General Electric. They have a combination of team and individual incentives and performance targets. Moderate strength of incentives, well, I would even call it high strength of incentives for European standards, for North America not so high. What do we see here? This is really one of the best practices of incentives. This is incentives, whatever GE does has this aureole of perfection and excellence. Right. So why is this incentive scheme so good? Let's now be a bit more serious and forget that it's General Electric. Okay, so there's a combination of team and individual incentives and performance targets. So we have team incentives, individual incentives, performance targets. Why do you need performance targets? Everybody knows in this course why you need performance targets: to increase the efficiency of the effort, which is higher when you do have a target, than when you don't have a target. Why do you have a combination of team and individual incentives? Because team and individual incentives taken separately, practiced separately, have their advantages and disadvantages. Now, how can you capitalize on the advantages of individual incentives and overcome the disadvantages of team incentives and vice versa? You have to bring together team incentives and individual incentives. And the philosophy here is that you use lots of measures of output. You have a balanced scorecard with lots of measures of performance. Now, the measures of performance that you can measure at the individual level, you reward individually. The measures of performance that you cannot estimate at the individual level, you reward at the lowest group level at which you can estimate them. Okay? So, for instance, being there on time is an individual performance outcome which you can very easily estimate at the individual level. Return on equity, a very frequently, or CapEx, right? So one of these accounting characteristics, or EBIT, earnings before income and tax. These are the accounting values that you cannot trace to individual contributions. There's no way you can do it in a credible and court enforceable way, right? Because these are the aggregate results of the performance of the entire organization. Therefore, you practice team incentives based on EBIT and CapEx, but you offer these incentives as team profit sharing plans rather than individual profit sharing plans. So there are team targets and there are also individual targets. When individual targets are met, individuals get their bonus. When team targets are met, the entire team gets their bonus. So that makes a lot of sense. The more I'm in business, the more I think that really this is really the best combination. You have team, individual incentives and targets. These are the three ingredients that make a very potent cocktail of incentives. A variation of this incentive scheme in a firm called Corning Glass. They practice group incentives and firm-wide incentives. They, for some reason, don't practice individual incentives, which I think is a bit weak. So most of the incentive package, 75% based, are based on group targets and 25% based on firm-wide performance measure, the return on equity. A firm called 3M, they practice very high incentives, very strong incentives. Their fixed wage is below the market average, but it quickly reaches the market level if performance targets are met. There is also small profit sharing components, which no one takes very seriously. Now, this incentive scheme is strong, but it's very precarious. And I don't think it will be sustainable in the long run. Why is it not sustainable in the long run? According to this incentive scheme, what is the mathematical expectation of wage? Is it below, at, or above the market wage? Below, exactly. Because only when you get to the target, which doesn't happen with 100% probability, only then will you get the market wage, right? So your mathematical expectation of wage is below the market. What are you doing at 3M is a good question, right? So a more sustainable incentive scheme would have the fixed wage below the market wage, but the bonus upon reaching a certain target should exceed the market wage so that the expected wage is above the market. It needs to be above the market to provide an insurance to risk-averse agents and to also attract high productive, low costs of effort people so as to take advantage of the selection effect that we know from the empirical literature. DuPont fibers. This is a subsidiary of the company called DuPont. Do you know this firm? It's a large US chemical conglomerate. It's very, very big. It's like BASF in Germany. Right. So, the 80s, they were very famous. There was Harvard Business School case study based on the incentives offered by DuPont. What made it so famous And what made it so infamous at the end, I have to say, is that they were one of the first firms that tried to practice the idea of deferred compensation, not to its managers in the form of deferred stock options, but to its workers in the form of deferred bonuses. So what they did, they said, okay, your wage is $100, but you will get $80 today. Why not 100? The $20 between your contract wage and the wage that you get, I will put in a safe deposit, right? Now, in 5 years' time, if the performance targets are met, then you will receive a multiple of this money, right? You will receive, let's say, $60 or $50. I don't remember exactly how much. Yeah? So, this is, of course, an incentive. If the targets are met, you will get more than what has been withdrawn from you, and there is a deferment so that people wouldn't fidget with short-term performance objectives and be more oriented towards reaching long-term targets and contributing to long-term value of the company. So from the naive theoretical perspective, this incentive scheme appeared to make a lot of sense. And In the first half of the 80s, it was a very, very successful incentive scheme. People really made a lot of money being in it. Now, in late 80s, there was a crisis. There was a mild recession. What happened? I don't know why there was a mild recession, but what happened is that people just kept paying their $20 for every $100 into this safe deposit with DuPont. But performance targets, which were introduced 5 years ago when times were good, were not met for a number of years in a row. And then people said, well, what's the point? You know, the market wage is $100. I receive 80 in the hopes of getting a multiple of 20 in 5 years' time. But the targets were installed in good years, and now it's bad years. The targets are not adjusted, and, you know, I'm losing money. So people started leaving DuPont. And in early 90s, this incentive pay was scrapped. Yeah. And the lesson from it, of course, is that performance targets are great. They deliver close to efficient solution. One problem with performance targets, which we so far haven't discussed, and I don't think we will discuss it in this course, is how do you set the target? Yeah. Do you set the target based on historical performance? Do you set the target based on some kind of benchmark? Where do you get the target from? Is a big problem. Yeah. So target, of course, is endogenously determined in the basic model of incentive pay. But what are the primitives based on which you derive the target? How do you observe them? And what are the strategic considerations that people may have in choosing their performance level with respect to the target? If I have a low target today, I can easily meet it. But if I work hard and pass the target with flying colors next year, my principal will say, okay, your target is now this much. And I don't want to have to work too hard in the next year. So I will suppress my effort today so as to keep the target at a low level. And yes, I will not get a lot of bonus, but at least I will get a bonus for 1 cent above the target in each year. This is called, you know, this is one of the known strategic behaviors with respect to the target. Okay, the last thing before we go is a brief reflection on long-term incentive plans. Long-term incentive plans. So much of the incentive schemes, and certainly all these Scanlon and Rooker plans that, you know, whose calculations we discussed today, They are all short-term incentive plans in terms of the grand classification of incentive schemes. So what is the short-term about them? Well, you have a performance measure which is realized today or at the end of the year, basically in a short run. And based on this short-term measure of performance, you receive your money today. Come next year, another measure of performance is realized, you receive or do not receive your bonus depending on that year's measure. What are the long-term incentives? Long-term incentives are the incentives based on performance outcomes that are realized over the period of several years. Right? So this is what, in a sense, DuPont Fibers tried to do, right? They had this five-year window during which period performance targets had to be made. So what is the reason why we, you know, even need to think between the think about short-term versus long-term incentives and choose between them? Well, the main reason is that people can do things that are not conducive to the long-term value of an organization if they are only motivated by short-term performance measures. And, you know, earlier on in this lecture, I gave you a couple of examples of such behaviors. In order to discourage these behaviors, firms practice long-term incentives. And in particular, during the recession years, a number of initiatives were taken by leading organizations, both voluntarily as well as the result of newly passed laws and regulations, that in effect meant that not all incentives should be based on today's profit. So two things have happened. First, they had these deferred stock option plans, which are still based on today's measure of performance, but you can exercise your option. You can sell your shares in, you know, 1, 3, or even 5 years time from now, so as to extend the horizon of planning and motivation. And the second thing that happened is that some incentive packages have started to be based on a rolling average of performance. So your typical incentive pay scheme is wage equals to some function of output in period T. This is a typical, right? With or without a target. But if you look at the incentive schemes in Volkswagen, for instance, you know, the Volkswagen practices incentive schemes which are based on rolling average profits. Namely, the profit averaged over, I think, 3 years from now. So your bonus today is a function not of the profits today, is a function of the profits today, last year, and 2 years ago, averaged. Okay? So does this make sense? Yes, it does make sense, because, you know, it adds more long-term perspective to the consequences of your action, right? The consequences of your actions today will continue affecting your incentives, your pay, not only today, but also in 2 years from now. Yeah, so you should be careful. One unfortunate side effect of these cumulative incentive schemes is when this diesel engine emission scandal broke out, the bosses of Volkswagen still received quite a lot of bonus. The sales plummeted because of the scandal, and the bosses received the bonuses. Why did they receive bonuses at all? Because if you take the average, it will be still a high amount. See what I mean? So the long-term incentive plans, they have a good reason to exist, but they, as any incentive plan, they are open to manipulation, and they can at some point fall victim to their own complication. So this cumulative or rolling average output-based incentives, of course, are not appropriate when there are abrupt shocks that affect performance in this year, because, you know, because the effect of this shock on wages will not be felt as badly in this year, it will be averaged out. And another issue with long-term incentive plans is that there is a disconnect between the time horizon which is relevant for the firm and the time horizon which is relevant for the worker. Yeah? So firms, it is true that an average firm exists for about 10 years, not a particularly long period of time. But successful firms, the growing firms, the sophisticated firms that practice incentives, they exist for longer than 10 years on average. Their life expectancy is more, right? So they think in terms of decades. Their horizon is very long. Their time horizon is very long. What is the time horizon of individual workers? The time horizon of individual workers is A couple of years, really, if you think about it. Because now people move jobs like never before. Yeah? So the disconnect between the length of the time horizon of the firms and the time horizon of the workers makes long-term incentives weaker to the workers. The firm thinks it's okay to incentivize your performance 5 years from now. But for individual workers, it's not okay, because in 5 years from now, the worker will have moved to another company, another city, or maybe even another country. Or maybe will have gone into retirement. So in order to bite, long-term incentives have to be strong, not only in terms of the value at stake, but also in terms of the time over which these benefits can be realized. So that's basically it. Oh, I overran a little bit. Sorry for that. See you next week.